Perhaps you saw the St. Louis Post-Dispatch op-ed piece last week. Picture of a monkey, a chimpanzee, reading a book on creationism, looking pensive. Under the heading, Intelligent Design or Intelligent Thinking, the subtitle says, on Charles Darwin's birthday, creationists posit that we were made complex species only through intelligent design and not random selection. But to accept that, we must submit to a new dark age and discard centuries of scientific achievement. Is that true? To believe in a literal six-day creation, or that midway point, to believe that there is an intelligent designer, whoever he might be, does that mean you discard all of science and the achievements of science? Does that mean a new dark age, not only for science, but for our culture and our intellect? We're going to talk about that during the first hour of Issues Etc. for about 20 minutes here. Then we'll have some open lines for your questions and your comments. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the second hour of the program, Craig Parton joins us. He's an attorney in Santa Barbara, and he's a former staff member for Campus Crusade for Christ. He's got a story to tell. It came down for him when he became disillusioned with Campus Crusade for Christ and the ahistorical, acreedal, aliturgical, asacramental theology of American evangelicalism. It came down to a choice between two things, and one of those things was Eastern Orthodoxy. You might have seen the story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Christian Orthodox Churches Here Plan Public Conference, because evangelicals are flocking to Orthodox churches, to Eastern Orthodox churches and other types of Orthodox churches. Why? We'll find out in the second hour of Issues Etc. today. In the third hour, Tom Baker joins us. He's host of the radio program Law and Gospel, heard here on AM 850 KFUO. In fact, in about 2 weeks, it will resume. Law and Gospel will. This will be part six of our seven-part series on the theology of glory versus the theology of the cross. Pastor Tom Baker is our guest in the third hour of Issues Etc. Joining us for the first part of this hour to discuss this op-ed piece, Intelligent Design and Six-Day Creation and Darwinian Evolution, Dr. David Menton. He's a regular guest here on Issues Etc., Associate Professor of Anatomy Emeritus at Washington University and speaker for Answers in Genesis. Dr. Menton, welcome back.
Well, pleasure to be here.
I should mention at the outset here that you are in our prayers. I understand you're going in for some surgery tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. Radiation implants to deal with a prostate problem here, so I appreciate the prayers.
Well, we will certainly keep you not only in our thoughts, but also in our prayers as well. You read the op-ed piece, Intelligent Design or Intelligent Thinking. It does kind of take a jaded view of creationism and intelligent design, and seems to assume that Darwinian evolution is the only sensible course for the education of our children or for anyone who's sensible to follow. Let's start with some definitions, if we could. Darwinian evolution, as it stands today, as it is being taught today, what does that viewpoint represent?
Well, as it's being taught today, it basically says that the origin of all living things, not just simply variations that can occur among the individuals of a species, but virtually the origin of life itself and of all living plants and animals in all of their complexity and variety can be explained by essentially a single, rather simple mechanism, which is random change due to mutations in the genetics of these organisms, and natural selection, which merely says that when you get random changes in the genes, that some of these changes will happen by chance to be an improvement in terms of the reproductive success of the organism. They'll have more offspring. And so it's really a one-size-fits-all, very, very simple explanation that random change in natural selection has produced everything.
This term, survival of the fittest, is kind of a way of saying in one sentence what you just said, that the fit or those that adapt to changes within their environment survive, and those that do not or who mutate in the wrong direction do not survive.
Yeah, that's a simple way to put it, but evolution has had to be refined with the development of modern genetics, and so now we think in terms of something that's called neo-Darwinism, which means new Darwinism, but it isn't really all that new. It dates back to the 50s or 60s, and they discovered that, you know, an organism could be fit in the sense of surviving, but that wouldn't necessarily contribute to its evolution. You really need to leave offspring. And so instead of just simply survival of the fittest, which is a bit of a tautology, now we say differential reproduction, so that every single random mutation, if it's to contribute to evolution, must do so by resulting in more offspring being produced. You could be the biggest, meanest animal in the forest, you know, but if you don't leave any offspring, you really don't contribute to the evolutionary scheme of things.
So in other words, even if, say, T-Rex is able to kill and eat all of its competitors for food, and even for mates, if it doesn't reproduce, it doesn't count in evolutionary terms.
That's right. We're not merely talking about reproduction here. We're talking about differential reproduction. That is, evolution finally has to depend on progressively more effective, efficient reproduction, leaving more and more offspring. Of course, it's kind of difficult how you then account for bacteria that produce in just huge quantities, even exponentially. Apparently not going very far in evolutionary speculation over the last several hundred million years, whereas elephants that reproduce once every 5 years have made great strides from their simple beginnings. But that is the general gist of the story. And of course, to me, the problem is that while there is such a thing as natural selection, I don't think that's the debated issue, you know, that nature can select among the individuals of the species. It doesn't really account for how we come to have really new animals. Natural selection could conceivably account for why you might have a larger population of black peppered moths rather than white or vice versa. But it really doesn't tell us how we come to have peppered moths in the first place.
Now, this brings us to another definition, and you said while there is such a thing as natural selection, can you distinguish for us between what's called microevolution and macroevolution?
Yeah, I think that's an important point we should establish, because oftentimes we are sold microevolution, which has an actual visible component. In other words, we can actually see it. It's not something that's theoretical or that anyone would deny. It's just simply observable. And then once we observe that, we're asked to then accept that when writ large becomes macroevolution. First of all, microevolution is a kind of variability that we are accustomed to seeing among the individuals of a species. I always like to use the example of dogs, because everybody knows a great deal about the tremendous variety of dogs we have out there, 150 varieties or more. And there are new varieties being added every few years that are accepted by the American Kennel Club. This is variation among the individuals of a species, and in this case we use what we call artificial selection. That is, man has gone in and selected for breeds that have met certain criteria that we want in a dog, whereas natural selection is presumably when nature itself, just due to differential reproduction, selects. So that nature might select, for example, for dogs that have a lot of hair. If the temperatures became very cold and only the woolier dogs could survive, you know, nature could select for that more hairy dog as opposed to the less hairy dogs, or larger dogs as opposed to smaller dogs. But this phenomenon, of course, exists. Plant breeders and animal breeders use it all the time. The simple point is there's a real limit to what you can get in this way. You simply can't keep selecting until you produce an animal that is, you know, unrelated to what you start with. Macroevolution is the kind of evolution we really tend to think about and what is taught in our schools, and that is how not merely you get different varieties of dogs, all of which can be explained quite well, but how you come to get dogs from animals that weren't even dogs to begin with, and how dogs might go on to evolve into some other non-dog creature in the future. This has never been observed to happen. And so we're looking at observable variation among the individuals of a species, which has sometimes been called microevolution. I don't like the word because it sounds like it's related to macro. Evolutionists themselves are not necessarily convinced that what we call microevolution, that is selection among the variability that exists in the species, is necessarily related to macro. And it's the macro that I think is the issue.
Okay, so in other words, much of what is handed out as evidence, and I put that in quotes, evidence for macroevolution, that is change between species, one species evolving into another species, is actually really evidence only for microevolution or just the basic existence of natural selection. I can't breed dogs into cats.
That's right. And the critical thing about the so-called microevolution is you're dealing with genes that already exist. In other words, we're not going to just look at one dog. We're going to look at, say, dogs collectively. We'll call all of the dogs and the genes that are in these dogs the gene pool of the species Canis familiaris, which is, the dog. And if you select from among the alternative forms of genes, and this is an important point I think to get across to people, is that animals and plants don't just come with one fixed set of genes. If that were the case, if every, say, dog had exactly the same genes, then presumably these dogs would be a clone. They'd all be the same sex, just for starters. They'd all have to be male or all female. And they would be like identical twins or a clone. But we know that nature is not that way. Identical twins are rare. And normally we have individuals that vary one from another. And this variability is due to the fact that there's not a carbon copy set of genes that represents dogs and another carbon copy set that represents humans, but rather there are different versions of many genes. That's how you get red hair and brown hair and blonde hair, what have you. It's all hair. It's all controlled by genes, as far as we know. But there are different versions. We call these alleles. So that's well understood scientifically, how you can select from alleles that are already existing. The question is, how do you get new genes that have never existed before? That requires a mutation, literally trying out by chance some new combination, or at least that's the kind of mutation we usually have in mind, is a random mutation. And the evolutionist argues that mutations, which of course we know can kill us, in fact cancer is really a mutation. They argue that while nobody really wants mutations in the short run, in the long run, it's produced all the diversity of life, and there really is no evidence for that.
All right, then by way of definitions, I want to talk about intelligent design as well, and I will remind our listeners that they are free to call. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What is intelligent design in a nutshell?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Richard Dawkins, who's written a very famous book, and a book that's mentioned in the article we were just commenting on, wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker, and he basically begins in the first page by saying biology is the study of systems that appear to be intelligently designed. And of course he goes on to argue that they aren't, but in other words, when we look at nature, whether you look at a human eye with its marvelous focusing mechanism for the lens and its ability to vary the amount of light input or bleach the retina to accommodate very bright light as opposed to very dim light, all of the wonderful features, say, in the human eye, intelligent design merely states that in an objective view of this eye, it has to reveal, or does indeed reveal, that it's the product of very low probability events, that is, of intentional, purposeful choices. And evolution argues, of course, vigorously in this article to a degree that is more crass than any I've ever seen before, the one in the Post-Dispatch. They argue that there is no purpose to evolution at all, that that nature merely counterfeits design. That yes, if you look at the human eye, you might naively think that it looks like it is intelligently designed for a purpose, but we scientists know that it wasn't. And so the intelligent design movement, which is popular today, is trying to, I guess, put a wedge into the evolutionary community by arguing that we can objectively determine design when we see it.
Now, we'll talk about this in just a few minutes. First, let's take some phone calls. Tim is calling from his car. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc., and thank you for waiting.
Hi, Pastor Wilkin. I have a question for Dr. Menton. He said that mutations giving rise to an evolutionary advance has never been observed. One thing I kind of wonder about is people say, like, bacteria that develop resistance to antibiotics, they consider that evolution, an evolutionary progression. I was wondering how Dr. Menton responds to that.
Thank you very much for the call, Tim. In fact, that is one of the issues raised, the objections to creationism and intelligent design raised by the op-ed piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. How do you respond?
Yeah, specifically in the Post-Dispatch, it says that, that if we get involved with creation, then we'll have no way to understand how pathogens, you know, bacteria, develop resistance to current generations of antibiotics and vaccines. This is simply not the case. Let's look at, for example, drug resistance in bacteria. One of the more common bacteria that plagues humans when you get to be about the age of 50 or 60 years old is a bacterium that produces stomach ulcers. And this particular Helicobacter bacterium is a bug that in the past was defeated with a particular drug. And the way the drug worked is that the drug would soak in through the surface of H. pylori, which is the bacterium we're talking about here, Helicobacter pylori, would soak in through the surface of this organism, you might say through its skin, although it doesn't really have a skin. And it would combine with a protein that is normally made inside the bacterium. Okay, so the drug was designed to complex with a normal protein in the bacterium. And when this combination is produced, it's toxic and it killed the bacteria. Now, when the bacteria became resistant to the most commonly used drug to fight it, you might think, well, there's evolution in action. Now this bacterium is resistant, so at least from the point of view of the bacterium, this is a positive thing. This is a evolution of a new trait. It turns out the mechanism by which the bacterium becomes resistant is through the loss of genetic information. In other words, a mutation results in the normal protein, which does have a function in the bacterium, results in the normal protein not being made or incorrectly made. As a result, the drug does not combine with the normal protein and the bacterium is resistant. In virtually every case we know of, there has never been a situation where we've produced fundamentally new genetic information. I mean, imagine if he actually had to come up with a new enzyme. And that would be certainly very simple, you'd think. You just have to have one new enzyme. I would think most complex systems would require a bit more than that. But a typical protein is about 500 amino acids long. And if you think of the number of nucleotide base pairs that have to fit together to code for 500 amino acids, to try to do this in anything based on any time scale that we're thinking about, never mind billions of years, we should be thinking of Googleplex years or Hubble times, you simply would not have enough time and material in the universe to come up with a single new biologically useful protein.
So in other words, if the analogy is, say, the phone book, completely accurate, that's the genetic information
right.
of this bacterium,
mm-hmm.
the bacterium that has actually become drug resistant or antibiotic resistant has done so by forfeiting some of the accurate information in the phone book.
That's right.
It's got some of the phone numbers wrong or left them out.
One of the names and phone numbers has been left out. And that name and phone number was necessary for this drug to work. But because that name and phone number has been deleted from the information of the phone book, the bacterium is now resistant to the drug. I can't emphasize too much. There is not a single case known where fundamentally new genetic information has been produced. Now, I can give you long lists of examples that are pretty impressive sounding of mutations, for example, resulting in three or more new enzymes, it would seem, at first blush. There's a certain bacterium that lives in the soil that can't utilize a particular sugar, needs a different sugar, and if you give it the sugar that's similar but not usable, most of the bacteria will die. But some of the bacteria will start thriving on it, and they found that you can have as many as three successive mutations resulting in three enzymes that allow it to use this abnormal sugar. Now you think, wow, there's evolution for sure. We have three enzymes, and I just told you you couldn't get one. Well, the answer here is so obvious, I'm embarrassed to even have to mention it, and that is these enzymes were clearly already in the genetic information of that bacterium. The challenge of having to live with this abnormal sugar causes, in a way not yet completely understood, these cryptic genes or these hidden genes to be triggered on so that a gene which wasn't used before now gets turned on and is used. What we don't get is the evolution of a new gene or a new enzyme. It was there from the beginning, as far as we know.
Yeah, I don't know, Dr. Metten, I'm approaching this purely from the layperson's, from a scientific layperson standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds to me a lot more, of course I'm biased, it sounds to me a lot more like an intelligent designer, perhaps, God forbid, even a creator, providing for the survivability of these creatures within the genetic code in adverse circumstances and when they don't have the kind of food they need and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the article that we read talks about the origin of life and in the Post-Dispatch and seems to argue that life has been shown to evolve through natural selection. And in fact, we don't have any evidence at all that life has evolved by natural selection. And this is not just creationists speaking here. Evolutionists themselves are amazed that life could ever have evolved. For example, Cowan and Harold Urey, publishing a few years ago in Christian Science Monitor, says, all of us who study the origin of life find that the more we look at it, the more we feel that it is too complex to have evolved anywhere. We all believe, as a matter of, or as an article of faith, that the life evolved from dead matter on this planet. It's just that its complexity is so great, it's hard for us to imagine that it did. So, you know, today in our classrooms, in our schools, I'm afraid we're giving a sort of a just-so story to our students. We're giving them this sort of pre-cut and dried and distilled package that we ask them to believe and pare it back on exams. And what I'd like to see in the school is for schools to critically evaluate the evidence for evolution.
Let's talk about that when we come back from this break. Dr. Metten, I was going to keep you just for about 20, 25 minutes, but if you would be kind enough, I'd like to keep you for the remainder of this hour. Is that okay?
Well, we'll try to do most of it anyway.
All right. Dr. David Metten is our guest associate professor of anatomy at Washington University and speaker for Answers in Genesis is our guest. We're talking about the op-ed piece that appeared in last week's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Intelligent Design or Intelligent Thinking. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 are our phone numbers. We'll be right back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are marketing principles compatible with Christian evangelism? Can Christianity be marketed like Coca-Cola, Ford, or Chevy? And how much have business practices influenced the Christian church? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org. Testing the Claims of Church Growth is written by a former marketing executive and now pastor, Rod Zwanitzer. Testing the Claims of Church Growth, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute raises the question, are Western Christians still needed as missionaries? Most of the church planting work around the world is accomplished with Christians in their own countries or crossing from one language group to another. But Western Christians are needed. In Asia, there's only one full-time Christian worker for every 2.7 million people. Mature Christians from around the world are crossing the globe in greater numbers. North American Christians are training Latin American Christians to reach the Muslim world. Korean and Singapore Christians are serving in North America or Europe. But the need remains for missionaries to work with local churches where they exist. A house church leader in China told an American Christian that neither the Westerners, Koreans, or Singapore Christians bothered to ask the local churches about their calling and vision. Pray for unified relationships among missionaries of all different cultures. Learn how to pray for missionaries by logging onto the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Terrorist warnings, plastic, duct tape. It's a time of some fear for all of us. Two seminary students gave me a list of over 250 scientifically documented fears. Some are well known, like agoraphobia, the fear of crowded public places. There's francophobia, the fear of France and French culture. That's a timely one. Other fears are interesting. Emathophobia, the fear of dust. Gynophobia, the fear of women, and androphobia, the fear of men. Mechanophobia, the fear of machines. And hundreds more, including pantophobia, the fear of everything. Why did Jesus so often tell his followers, do not fear? He wouldn't have said it if they weren't afraid. He knows we are too. So, admit that you are afraid of whatever, and take it to the Lord in prayer. Almighty God, because you know that we are set among so many and great dangers, that by reason of the weakness of our fallen nature, we cannot always stand upright, grant us your strength and protection to support us in all dangers and carry us through all temptation, through our Lord Jesus Christ.
We thank
Christ.
Reliable Heating and Amen. Cooling for being a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO. Here's a few winter heating tips from Reliable. Don't let your furnace filters get dirty. Check the filters at least once a month, replace disposable filters, or clean the permanent ones whenever they do look dirty. Reliable Heating and Cooling performs routine maintenance such as cleaning filters and humidifiers. 8463 Delport Drive, Reliable Heating and Cooling, 314-423-3535.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. David Menton is our guest. We're talking about creation, evolution, and intelligent design. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We do want to address one of the issues brought up by this op-ed piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch having to do with what should be the plan for education, especially of our children and young people, when it comes to these issues of the origins of life. But first, let's talk with you. Matt is calling from Richmond Heights. Matt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, I love to hear Dr. David Menton, and I love this topic. And I am happy to ask a question. Presumably, the opponents of intelligent design and creation, as taught in our Holy Bible, are intelligent people. And yet, when we look at the mathematical probabilities of the difficulties of putting these building blocks of life together in the proper order, they would be, like you mentioned a while ago, astronomical and time periods exceeding anything that our minds could grasp would be necessary if that probability were to ever exist. And so how is it that just from the mathematics of it, 2 + 2 = 4, liberals, Republicans, conservatives, Democrats, everybody agrees about that, and they would presumably agree about the impossibilities of these mathematical things happening. why doesn't that settle the issue?
And that's a great question, Matt. How do proponents of evolution deal with the mathematical probabilities and problematic probabilities?
Well, first of all, I would agree that, you know, the people who take the evolutionary point of view are intelligent people, too. It's not like we have people who are idiots competing with those who understand things. There are intelligent people on both sides of this issue, and there are some folks who aren't very bright on both sides of this issue. I think it has to do with the bias that we start with. You recall here a few years ago the big battle going on in Kansas, which went to Ohio after Kansas, of teaching creation in schools, and or at least criticizing evolution. And there was a letter written to Nature by a fellow from Kansas State University by the name of Scott Todd, who was commenting on you know, this dreadful possibility that we might be bringing creation into the schools or criticizing evolution. And he said, and I quote, "Even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such a hypothesis is excluded from the sciences because it's not naturalistic." So you see, the thing that's intriguing here is there is a bias that says all scientific explanations must be naturalistic. Now, I'm not opposed to that so far. In other words, we can't invoke miracles to explain scientific phenomena. The problem comes up, however, when we say because science is limited to naturalistic explanations, we must assume then that all origins are due to natural phenomena. And I don't think that necessarily follows. If we look at, for example, a computer, we could study the computer and see how it works, and if you knew enough about computers, you could analyze it and see how and why it works the way it works.
It's not magic going on inside that
box. Right, or if you look at a Ford Taurus, you know, if you never saw one before but you knew something about mechanics, you could analyze it in a purely mechanical, materialistic way and explain how it works, why the wheels go around, why the pistons go up and down, why the fuel gets carbureted. All of that could be explained in purely materialistic terms, and no mechanic would accept, you know, some supernatural explanation for how the wheels turn or whatever. The problem is when we leave the realm of the car as it exists, the Ford as it exists, and we go on to ask the question, how do we come to have Fords in the first place, or Ford Tauruses? There, if we try to use the same purely mechanistic arguments that we can use in terms of looking at its ongoing process, we call that process science, if we try to use that for origins, we run into trouble. You cannot explain how a Ford Taurus comes into being as a Ford Taurus with all of its parts by merely looking at the material out of which the car is made. You have to look outside the car to the mind, or minds, as I'm sure the case is with the car, that conceived and built it for a purpose. But in biology, we don't do that. In biology, we insist that somehow, or at least evolutionists insist, that we can use the same materialistic explanations for origins as we do for studying the ongoing processes of life. And I don't think there's evidence to support that.
So it sounds like all idea is doing, all intelligent design is doing, while it falls short of any theological statements, it does not, it expressly says we're not going to make statements about the designer or about the deity or anything like that. All it is arguing is let us apply the same rules we would to, say, examining the Ford Taurus as we would, same rules there as and the same rules to examining the human body or the microbe or whatever it may be.
That's right. For example, there's three basic tests that you can apply to something to determine whether it's a product of design or not. These ideas were proposed by William Dembski in his very interesting book called Intelligent Design. He's one of the leaders in the design movement. And Dr. Dembski said, look, you can look at any object or phenomena that you might encounter in nature or wherever, land on another planet and you see something there on the ground and you pick it up and you look at it. The question is it due to the intrinsic properties of nature, time, and chance, or is it due to an intelligent designer and artificer? And he says, here's the questions you ask. First, you ask, does chance explain it? In other words, can we explain the object or phenomena that we're looking at by chance? And there that becomes a statistical argument. You have to run the statistics to show whether, in fact, it's reasonable to account for the event by chance. Chance doesn't explain it, then you can go to the next step. You can say, is there a law of nature that explains it? If I drop a baseball, it's going to the floor. It's not going to the ceiling. And if I drop it 10 times in a row, it goes to the floor each time. A general law of gravity says that not only does this happen on Earth, but it happens everywhere in space, going towards a body of greater mass. And there are even mathematical formulas that make this very, very precise, that describe this in a precise way. So it could be that a law explains it. For example, take the hexagonal pattern that you see in a bee's honeycomb. A person might look at that and say, oh my, this is a wonderful design. There must be something that the bee is doing or something really wired into this bee that allows it to make these perfect hexagons to store honey in because it represents the least amount of wax possible for the maximum amount of honey volume. You can't partition any fluid more efficiently than with proximate hexagons. But if you look at soap bubbles floating in water, you'll find they're hexagonal too, if you have a single layer of soap bubbles. So here is a basic law of close packing that explains it. So the third step is, if chance doesn't explain it and if a law of nature doesn't explain it, the third possibility is it specified complexity? Is it design? And there you have to look at the sorts of evidence that we have that are in the fields of informatics and what have you to show that we have information that is not a result of chance. When we look at fractures in a mountain or crevices from ice and snow, we don't think somebody went up and carved those cracks in the mountain. But when we look at Mount Rushmore and we see those heads up there, even if we didn't know what people were or presidents were, we could still look at those heads and see that this is not a process of random weathering, that the cracks have in fact violated some of the more likely cleavage pathways due to the grain in the rock and have gone in ways which have very low likelihood of having happened if they weren't forced to happen. So this is really, in a nutshell, the essence of the intelligent design argument.
Back to the phones. Lewis is calling from South St. Louis. And Lewis, thank you for being patient.
Sure. I enjoy your debate very much. What's interesting, I believe in both. I believe in God and evolution. I think that's how he did it. And one thing is, without getting into the specifics, if one just looks at any magazine, if you're in a store, you just look in there and you'll find out that the scientists believe in evolution. So the question arises, how do you respond to an overwhelming, that these people, these scientists believe in it? Or you watch, something, an astronomy program or something on TV, and the experts in that area will cite evolution, and it goes on and on and on. So how can you argue against overwhelming, scientific experts in their opinion? But
okay, Lewis. Now that's a good question. Let me ask this one first. Lewis says he believes in both evolution and intelligent design. In essence, this is how God achieved that. Is that logically consistent, Dr. Menten?
Well, in my understanding, of course, it would not be logically consistent. The key thing in evolution is that there is no ultimate purpose. If you take that away from evolution, you've destroyed evolution. If you have anything in there sort of stacking the dice, forcing things to come out one way rather than another, then you're not dealing with evolution anymore. Evolution must be without any constraints whatever. It must be due to the vagaries of nature itself and how one manages to package in a sovereign God, one to whom one might pray, for example, when God merely sets back and lets nature run its course. By the way, the article that was in the paper said that nothing feels like a prayer, so the writer didn't have a very high confidence in the power of prayer. So in my understanding of Christianity, there simply would not be any compatibility. I think one of the problems that Christians have that try to make their peace with Darwin is that in evolutionism, death is natural. In other words, you can't have evolution without death. If everything worked, if everything lived, if everything survived, I mean, where's evolution? Where's natural selection? Evolution functions by these random changes, obviously the vast majority of which are terrible, are dreadful. In fact, a lot of the changes would be the undoing of whatever chance good things might have happened earlier. I mean, you might expect the wind to blow a pack of cards and have them spontaneously form into a card castle. That's not very likely, but you could imagine it happening. But wouldn't the next puff of wind be likely to tear it down? And so those who try to combine a belief in evolution and the biblical account of creation or God, I think face the problem of a process which makes death natural. And the Bible, I mean, the whole essence of the Bible, the essence of Christianity, is that death is not natural to man, that man was created to live forever, and that when sin came into the world, death came into the world. And death is not a good thing that God has created for our benefit. In fact, the Bible's quite clear. It refers to death as that last enemy that will be destroyed when the Lord returns. Now, as for what about all these scientists that believe differently, first let me say I was a very successful scientist for many years, and I didn't believe in evolution, and my colleagues knew it, and my students knew it, and despite this fact, I was given awards for both my teaching and research, twice appointed Professor of the Year by my students. You could take evolution out of Washington University School of Medicine, where I taught, and it would have no effect whatever on our understanding of medicine. It contributes nothing of any use. The article seems to imply in the Post-Dispatch that Christianity was sort of the death knell to science, that as the church assumed leadership activity in the fields of medicine, technology, and science, these areas all but collapsed, it's argued. And this simply isn't true. In fact, science has really only flourished and been sustained in societies that have a Judeo-Christian tradition, and pioneers in virtually every area of science and medicine were themselves creationists. For example, in physics, we have nothing less than Newton, Faraday, Maxwell, and Kelvin. In chemistry, Boyle, Dalton, and Ramsey. In biology, Ray, Linnaeus, Mendel, Pasteur, Virchow, Agassiz. You know, Rudolf Virchow, it's interesting, he was the father of modern pathology, and yet in the article in the Post-Dispatch, it says that what will happen to the future of our virologists and pathologists if we don't accept evolution. And Rudolf Virchow was the father of the whole field and was a creationist. So there's a lot of misinformation that we have to filter through.
One quick phone call and its answer, and then, as promised, we will let Dr. Menten go about his business. Eric is calling from his car. Eric, our time is short. Welcome to the program. All right, Eric has dropped out. I think we made him wait a little too long. The contention is made, last question, Dr. Menten, the contention is made that intelligent design, obviously making it a distinction between that and the theological statement of a six-day creation according to Genesis, that intelligent design really is just a Trojan horse for bringing six-day creationism, the biblical view of the origin of life, into the classroom. Do you accept that contention?
Well, you know, no matter what you teach about origins, it will be pregnant with religious implications. And evolution is itself every bit as religious. People get the idea that religion only refers to a belief in a God. You know, if you look at Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, one of the definitions of religion is a cause, principle, or system of beliefs held to with ardor and faith. And that certainly would fit Mr. Carter, who wrote this article in the Post-Dispatch. To show you how religious evolution is, Michael Roos, who's a professor of philosophy and zoology at the University of Guelph in Canada, is a very, very ardent evolutionist and anti-creationist, and writes and speaks a great deal and is involved in all of the court cases going on in the various states regarding teaching. And this is what Michael Roos said in the National Post, May 13th of 2000, published in Canada, on pages B1, B3, and B7. He said, and I quote, "Evolution is promoted by its practitioners as more than mere science. evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it's true of evolution still today. Evolution, therefore, came into being as a kind of secular ideology, an explicit substitute for Christianity. End quote. Now, that's an evolutionist himself and an anti-creationist. And the thing that's really sad is only this religion of evolutionism is permissible in our schools. It may be that when our astronauts die tragically in space, we temporarily appeal to a God who's the creator and the savior and who's in control of everything. But once we get back to school again, then God is out of it, and we deal with the world as though God can be ignored in history, God can be ignored in science, and God is even ignored, and the Bible's ignored in ethics, in medicine, and every other field, and I think our society is falling apart as a result of it.
Dr. David Menton, I would love to be able to keep you for another hour if we could, but thank you very much for giving us your time.
My pleasure.
Dr. David Menton is Associate Professor of Anatomy Emeritus at Washington University and Speaker for Answers in Genesis. We've been talking about this op-ed piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch of last week titled Intelligent Designer, Intelligent Thinking. It really was kind of a snide, to put it crassly, it was a snide approach to the whole issue. But this has, beyond op-ed pieces, this has actual results. Did you hear about this? This was an AP story from about 2 weeks ago. Just been sitting in my open lines file waiting for an opportunity, and here it is. Biology professor investigated for religious bias. Teacher refuses to write letters of recommendation for students who don't believe in evolution. Now, Dr. Menton just got done saying that evolution, even by its own admission, by the admission of its own brightest lights, is essentially a religious belief. You might argue it's a godless religion, or a religion in which God is nature itself, or the evolutionary force, natural selection, whatever. Here's the story. Again from the AP. A biology professor who refuses to write letters of recommendation for his students if they don't believe in evolution is being accused of religious discrimination, and federal officials are investigating, the school said. The legal complaint was filed against Texas Tech University and Professor Michael Denny by a student and the Liberty Legal Institute, a religious freedom group that calls Denny's policy open religious bigotry. Students are being denied recommendations not because of their competence in understanding evolution, but solely because of their personal religious beliefs, said Kelly Shackelford, chief counsel for the institute. The Department of Justice asked Tech in a January 21st letter to respond to the allegations, university officials said. Texas Tech spokesman Cindy Ruggley said that the university stands by Denny and that his policies do not conflict with those of Texas Tech. Quote, a letter of recommendation is a personal matter between a professor and a student and is not subject to university control or regulation. Now, that was a quote from Texas Tech Chancellor David Smith in October. Denny, an associate professor who has been at Texas Tech for 10 years, said Wednesday he didn't know about a federal inquiry. He referred questions about his policy to a web page that outlines it. The web page advises students seeking a recommendation to be prepared to answer the question, how do you think the human species originated? If you cannot truthfully and forthrightly affirm a scientific answer to this question, then you should not seek my recommendation for admittance to further education in the biomedical sciences. I wonder if he gives bad grades on the basis of that question, too. You see what I mean? I mean, if he won't write a letter of recommendation because he says, I don't think you are fit to study further in the biomedical sciences, even if and he knows the student believes in, say, intelligent design or a six-day creation. If he knows that a student believes this, but the student gives all the right answers on the quizzes and on the tests and writes the papers all in line with this professor's views of evolution, does he dock their grade? I mean, they're not fit. One might even argue he's enacting his own form of unnatural selection. The legal complaint began with Texas Tech student Micah Spradling, who withdrew from Denny's class and the university in the fall and enrolled in Lubbock Christian University after learning about Denny's policy. Spradling, 22, wants to become a physician and said he needs a letter of recommendation from a biology professor, but as a creationist, he said he couldn't sit there and truthfully say, I believe in human evolution. It's a theory. You read it about it in the textbooks, he says. It could explain the process. Maybe somehow some people say it happens, but I couldn't have said I believe in it, Spradling said on Wednesday. I don't really see how believing in evolution, the evolution of humanity, has anything to do with patient care or studying science. Spradling re-enrolled at Texas Tech this semester after obtaining a recommendation letter at the other school. Denny writes that he has the policy because he doesn't believe anyone should practice in a biology-related field without accepting the most important theory in biology. Well, at least he's kind enough to admit that it was just a theory. Good scientists would never throw out data that does not conform with their expectations or beliefs, he writes. Denny also says that he refuses to write letters of recommendations for students he doesn't know fairly well and those who haven't earned an A in one of his classes. What if he knows you well, you earned an A, but you don't believe in evolution? Department spokesman George Martinez refused to confirm or deny an investigation citing department policy. That's according to the Associated Press. It actually happens, folks. Texas Tech is no backwater university. Now, for those of you who are curious, I do not have the actual date on the op-ed piece I'm referring to from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. What I have is the actual op-ed piece cut out of the newspaper minus date. It was called Intelligent Design or Intelligent Thinking. You might be able to find it at stltoday.com, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It's not the best website in the world. You might have to search the archives. But if you're an intelligent designer or a creationist, brace yourselves before you read it, because as I said, it's rather snide. Coming up in the next hour of Issues Etc., Craig Parton will join us. We're going to be talking about American evangelicals and Eastern Orthodoxy. Somebody says Wednesday, February 12th was the time for the op-ed piece, so you can look it up under that date if you like. Wednesday, February 12th, Intelligent Design or Intelligent Thinking. Craig Parton will be talking about Eastern Orthodoxy, two things that seem so far apart on the pole. Eastern Orthodoxy and its traditional, very traditional, beliefs and practices. And American evangelicalism, which changes every time the weather changes. Why are people from American evangelicalism flocking to Eastern Orthodoxy? We'll get an answer to that question when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.